And I failed to mention during the announcements that I noticed online that Southside was having a meeting starting today, going through Wednesday. And I didn't get a flyer, or it could have been that it just came too late in the mail. But so be aware of that. Southside there in Bowling Green, Monday and Tuesday is the nights that we could go at 7 o'clock, just so you're aware of that. All right. Well, as often as I like to do, I have a continuation. And so, again, if you weren't able to be here this morning, consult the website. When I get the lessons up there, you get the first part of the lesson. But we're continuing this lesson I titled Confessions of a Denominational Man. This man who wrote, he said, "When I first began studying the early Christian writings, I was surprised by what I read. In fact, after a few days of reading, I put the writings back on the shelf and decided to scrap my research altogether. They frequently taught the opposite of what I believed, and they even labeled some of my beliefs as heretical. Instead, though," he went on and read on, and then he published a book on what he read titled, "Will the Real Heretics Please Stand Up?" It's by David Barakat. He considers himself to be an evangelical Christian. We mentioned the time setting of these writings. We understand the Bible contains the work of the apostles, the early disciples of Christ that were inspired to write. The early writers, the early Christian writers, happened to be within the lifetime of some of those, or the lifetime of some of those that knew them. They're sometimes referred to as the church, early church fathers, but like I said this morning, they wouldn't have appreciated such a title. They did not view themselves that way, but just as simply Christians. Disciples, no better or worse than anybody else, just simply servants of the Lord. But a lot of their writings are invaluable resources. But whether it's David Barakat or even some of the writings of these individuals, we recognize them to be men. And they never ever put themselves above the writings of inspired Scripture. They recognize that they were not inspired themselves, that they themselves could be wrong. But we were trying to make the point, who might better understand the cultural context and even the language and speak in the same language as the apostles to best understand maybe some of these scriptures that are so misunderstood today? It would make sense that they would have a better grasp or understanding being that close to the early disciples. And so these evidences are writings from the group of believers who personally knew the apostles, or some of those that had known them. Now, David Barakat wrote, he says, "I've not represented any beliefs or practices being those of the early church in general unless they met the following criteria, and that is that all early Christians, writers who mentioned the subject, expressed the same view." So that was something that he wanted to make sure. It wasn't just an esoteric view here out there in the middle of nowhere, but they all expressed the same united belief in this. So what we discussed this morning, if you weren't here, just real quickly a recap. We noticed that all early Christians there in that time period after the apostles, they all taught that a person is not saved by faith alone. And we shared those quotations. That a Christian can lose their salvation. And we shared those quotations. And that water baptism was understood universally by all of them as essential to salvation. But as I said at the end of the lesson, that was not all the things that they taught. There were other things that they also taught as well. Now, interesting to me, in David Barakat's book, he didn't actually discuss the topic of instrumental music. However, I knew that the early Christians believed the truth regarding that. And so I went to work to find some of those quotes. But we always start with the Bible first, because that is our true standard. In Ephesians chapter 5, there in verse 19, there the Apostle Paul says to be speaking to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Not on your harp, but in your heart to the Lord. Singing and making melody. Speaking to one another. I can't speak through an instrument or a piano, but I can speak with words. And that's the kind of music that the first church used. In Colossians chapter 3 and verse 16. Colossians 3 verse 16. "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. Again, in James chapter 5 and verse 13, James 5:13, is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing psalms. And we might even throw in, I've got Hebrews 13:5, but I also like Hebrews chapter 2, Hebrews 2 and verse 12, saying, I will declare your name to my brethren. In the midst of the assembly, I will sing praises to you. We've got 10 passages in the New Testament that talk about what kind of song God wants, and every one of them mentions vocal music, singing, without exception. That's the pattern that God established for the New Testament church. And the New Testament church clearly understood that. Did you know there's actually no record of instruments being introduced to any churches of any kind until 600 years after the death of Christ? And even after that, it was very sparingly. Most churches rejected it and saw it as unscriptural. That is why the word a cappella, which means vocal music, literally means in the original Latin, it means as the church. Because they understood that the church sang purely vocally. Well, again, the early Christians understood this. Clement of Alexandria, here mention this individual who turned from human philosophy to Christ. And much of what he learned from those near apostle lives, he shared with others. In time, he became an elder at the church in Alexandria. And here's what he said. He said, leave the pipe to the shepherd and the flute to the men who are in fear of gods and intent on their idol worshiping. He connected instrumental music with those that served the gods of one's own devising among the Gentiles. Another man by the name of Eusebius, an elder in Caesarea, he wrote a complete history of the church from the apostles unto his day. And hear what Eusebius said. He said, the unison voices of Christians would be more acceptable to God than any musical instrument. And it's plainly because that's what we read revealed in the New Testament. Justin Martyr, again, another individual we mentioned this morning. I didn't mention that he did die a martyr's death, and that's why he received that nickname, Martyr, Justin Martyr. In 165 AD, he died. He said musical organs pertain to the Jewish ceremonies and agree no more to us than circumcision. Sometimes individuals will offer that argument. Well, you read that David used an instrument. The Jews used an instrument. Yes, we know that. They face those same arguments too. But they recognize that was part of the old economy, the Jewish worship. And he said, if we go back to that, then we might as well start binding circumcision, which we know God did not allow. Right? We might as well go about building temples in Jerusalem and again requiring everybody to travel to Jerusalem 3 times a year because that's what was commanded under the Old Testament. So if we want to worship as the Old Testament people did, we can use an instrument, but we got to do those other things too. But now that we're under Christ, we see very plainly the praises we offer were to sing. The early Christians understood that. They upheld that. Another early Christian by the name of Athenagoras, who lived from 150 to 190 AD, he said, now if the cosmos is a harmonious instrument set in rhythmic motion, I worship him who tuned it, who strikes its notes and sings its coordinate melody, not the instrument. So he says, I'm going to tune my focus and worship to the one who has finally tuned our universe and not the instrument. Well, so far, what we have seen, most of us would say, boy, it sure is neat to see that they upheld a lot of things that I believe and teach, you know, things that I've held for a long time. But as I said this morning, there may be some surprises at individuals that when it came to the moral conduct of these early Christians' lives, they were very pure and kept themselves from evil to the very best of their ability and made application of scriptures that talked about refraining from acts of worldliness. I think in a lot of ways these things were taught more frequently in churches of Christ in days gone by, but have sometimes slipped its way out of the pulpit, and sadly we see into the lives of many members by not living as they ought to live. Well, in John chapter 15, there in verse 18, Jesus has always talked about this separation from worldliness that his disciples ought to have. In John 15, verse 18, he said, "If the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. Yet because you're not of the world, because I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you." So he said, you know, don't be surprised when they turn their cannons on you, because you have ultimately shown the light of truth on their living, and you won't go along with it. Understand, they did that to me too. They hated me, and so therefore they hate you. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11, 1 Peter 2:11, there Peter said, "Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul." That's the kind of lives they practiced, was abstinence. Abstain from your fleshly lusts, because it fights against the soul. In Romans chapter 8, and notice verse 12 and verse 13. Romans 8, 12 and 13. "Therefore, brethren, we are debtors not to the flesh to live according to the flesh. For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live." Again, strict separation from worldliness. James chapter 4 and verse 4, one of the strongest passages in all the Bible. James 4 and verse 4, "Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." And so these early Christians lived these scriptures in their lives. Cyprian, you might remember I mentioned him this morning. He shared an instance one time in a letter where there was a pagan actor that came to Christ, obeyed the gospel of Jesus, and he recognized in his profession as an actor, much like many actors' professions today, there's much immorality that they have to be engaged in or do or portray to be this character. Oftentimes it mentioned that there would be homosexuals that would be involved in a lot of these plays, and they would play the role of the woman. And so he wanted to give up this profession, to no longer be a part of it anymore. And Cyprian was encouraged by that, and even told the brethren at that church, since that was his sole way of earning income, that the church ought to seek to step up and support him and help him until he's able to find a different trade in life. That's how much they supported each other in trying to make sure that they stayed separate from the world. It made me wonder how many would give up their jobs today if they were to be an actor. I know there's one Christian in Bowling Green who was pursuing some of this, and he also found himself having to walk this tightrope and realize it just wasn't possible. And so he chose a different profession altogether. What about someone that was a bar employee and they learned the gospel, or worked at a casino or a public pool where they stared at immodest individuals all the day long, and they learned this is just an environment I can't be a part of, that I can't just go along with and say it's okay? How strongly do we want to live lives separate from worldliness? See, these early Christians didn't just go sit in the pools and hang out, or go to dances and hang out, or to bars and hang out, or go to strip clubs and hang out. No. And before you think, well, they didn't have those things in those days, you're absolutely incorrect. They had all of those things in those days, and even more so. Rome was a very decadent and worldly country, nation, empire. And they knew that if God was holy, that they were supposed to be holy too, set apart from the world. So there's something wrong with our heart when we see how close to sin we can get, when the Bible teaches that we ought to do the opposite. You know, the Bible teaches that individuals ought to adorn themselves modestly. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 3, Peter says, "Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God." In 1 Timothy chapter 2, 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, "In like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair, or gold, or pearls, or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works." And so he said that our dress can profess something about us. Either we are with God and godly, or are we with the world and worldly. Our dress ought to profess godliness. Romans 12:1, "I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." A lot of people have heard these passages all their life, and they're okay with it. But when the preacher or teacher starts to make application of that, oh, wait a second now. But listen, we need to make application to our lives. When we say, is this modest apparel or this immodest apparel? You know, the early Christians did that very thing. Clement of Alexandria, he said, "Luxurious clothing that cannot conceal the shape of the body is no covering at all. Such clothing, clinging close to the body, takes the body's shape and adheres to the flesh. It outlines the woman's figure so that the whole shape of her body is visible to the spectators, even though they cannot actually see the body itself. Such clothing is meant for looking, not for covering." See, this is what the early Christians taught. Remember, David Bearcutt said, "I'm only going to share with you what all the early Christians taught." Oh yes, we like what they teach in regards to once saved, always saved, and faith only in water baptism. Well, do you like when they teach about modest apparel and separation from worldliness? Because they all taught these things. Now, David Bearcutt, being in a denomination, we can only imagine the links, or I might say the shortness of the things that he sees out in those places where these topics are not touched anywhere closely. I wish I can say it's only denominations that have that problem. But sad, sometimes you can tell in some Christians' social media feeds, they're not shy. They are not blushing at all, freely willing to share much of their exposed bodies, or athletic clothing that is so clingy, so tight, that reveals the very shape and form, like he said, even though you cannot actually see the body itself, the whole shape of her body is visible. You know, they had mixed swimming and modest dress being done in those days. And I'm sorry, the picture came up a little bit too early there. But bathing was a national pastime. And public baths were one of the primary meeting places of Roman society. They called them baths. We call them swimming pools. It was the same thing. And you had Christians that would write against these things very publicly, saying this is not the place for us to be. We need to refrain from that. Clement of Alexandria, again here, he said, "Some women will scarcely undress in front of their own husbands out of pretense of modesty, but anyone else who wants to may see them in their baths, for they are not embarrassed to strip before spectators." Again, he's not going to share these quotes unless they were enumerated by all Christians, that they all uniformly said these things. That mixed swimming was not a place where Christians ought to be in their in places where everyone's indecently exposed. And yet we often hear frequently, sometimes sadly, of Christians going to these public places where everybody else is unclothed. Now they might say, well, I've got my clothes on, but you're there staring at everybody that doesn't. They early Christians would have flat out condemned that. They did. Here's some of their writings. David Bearcott made a most striking application. He said, most Christians would be quite embarrassed to be seen in public in their underwear. Yet they think nothing of relaxing at a poolside in the swimsuits that are no less revealing. We appear in public swimwear that would have shocked even non-Christians only 50 years ago. Yet because it's acceptable now, we think nothing of it. Friends, this is a denominational man who's now accepting more conservative views than some of our own brethren. David Bearcott went on to say in his book, he said that he used to think that those that objected to this kind of, you know, thing, he says that immodest mixed swimming, he says that he says, I thought they were prudish. I thought they were Victorian. He said, but reading the writings of the early Christians made him rethink his position about that. And he taught to his denominational brethren, he says, we find today's evangelical Christianity far removed from early Christianity. We label as heresy many of the doctrines the early Christians taught, and they labeled as heresy many of the doctrines we teach. Who are the real heretics? And could there be real heretics among us? I see some things that we need to seriously always consider. Are we really wanting to be separate from the world, different from the world, to let our light shine? When we tell our friends, I'm sorry, we can't be there to do this kind of thing. I mean, that's difficult, and it's hard for some of them to hear. They might think we're prudish, like David Bearcott thought at one time. But if they study the Scriptures, and if they ever took time to read the writings of the early Christians, they'll see that that actually was the way of God, the way of Christ. Now, what was interesting, David Bearcott began to think, you know, what helped protect this early church from apostasy? Why did they have this uniformity of beliefs for centuries? How'd they keep united, especially, and even wrote in his book, since there's like over 22,000 different denominations today? How were they so united? And so he looked at the various historical markings, and he said they all agreed on a few things, and that was that there was no new revelation from God. That when the New Testament was completed, that was it. That was their source of authority. That's what they'll go to, and not to the opinions of men. They also taught very strongly the church's separation from the world. So there would be a stark contrast between them and the world. The independence of each congregation. So that if one congregation went into error, that didn't mean that all the other ones did. And also, ironically, he said physical persecution. That these were pillars ultimately that helped keep the church sound and solid. He said these walls helped protect till they came crumbling down in the 300s AD as Christianity became popular to the Roman world. And ultimately, when Constantine was supposedly converted. He said this, he said, when Satan tried to coerce Christians by force, he failed miserably. However, when he laid out the red carpet, she capitulated almost instantly. It's kind of like Aesop's fable. Remember the sun and the wind as they're competing, which one is more powerful? And so they say, well, let's just offer this competition. Whoever can get the man to take off his coat is the more powerful one. And the sun said to the wind, you go first, while he stepped behind the cloud. And the wind blew and blew and blew. In fact, the harder he blew, the more tightly the man clung to his coat. And when the wind had lost his breath, he stepped aside, and the sun came out and shined his lovely rays upon the man. And within a few minutes, he starts to take it off. See, that's what happened to the early church. When it faced resistance and fighting, it clung tighter to Christ. But when things became easy and things became smooth, They took off the coat of Christ and put aside the armor of God. They became soft with the persecution ending, believing changing for the times was not so bad after all. You see, the early church almost equated change to apostasy, and so they fought against that. But now, with things different, they sought many new ways to quote unquote convert people. And it's really intriguing how David Barakat brings this out. Page 127, he said, they evangelized through dazzling architecture. Hey, you know, those old little rundown buildings, that's not a really great way to appeal to people. Let's make these elaborate cathedrals so when people walk in there, Instead of carrying the cross, they marketed the cross, he said in page 128. So ways in which to, again, draw up business to make it a good thing to be a Christian. You're not having to carry it. No. It's like the health and wealth gospel. Everything's going to be better now in your life. And then he said, even on page 129, that the way to the pagan's heart they learned is through his stomach. See that? The social gospel being used to bring in people when it became easy and popular to be a Christian. Here's what he said. He said, today's church growth has become an obsession. Methods that produce rapid church growth are soon adopted by church after church. The big rage right now is the multi-million dollar church recreation complexes called Family Life Centers. From what I've observed, churches with expensive recreation centers grow much faster than those without. You know what he said? But so what? The fourth century church proved we can use human methods to create a bigger church, but it did not prove that we can create a better church. What we would say, because we're very schooled in authority, is we'd say it didn't create a scriptural church. We recognize that as unscriptural, departing from the pattern. But he recognized that these churches swelled with weak as water members. No conviction. Could easily deny Christ if it meant their life was on the line. Because they were brought in by gimmicks. The way to the pagan's heart was through his stomach. This is intriguing to me. Because remember, this man's not a member of the Church of Christ. And yet he's speaking more strongly about these things than some of our institutional liberal brethren. They ought to go and learn from him. The early church, when it was sound and solid and strong, did not try to bring people in with these means. But when it became popular, it capitulized. It took off its coat, so to speak, and brought people in any way they thought would be good to do. It is very, very interesting to see the omissions of this man. Now, you may be wondering, what did the man do with all of this? And I'll tell you, when I was reading this book for the first time, that was exactly what I was asking. And I tried to withhold my temptation from just jumping to the very end and seeing what did he do. In fact, his last chapter is, so what does all this mean for us? Right? So what, right? What's the conclusion to all this? I can see you're on the edge of your seat. You want to know too, don't you? Well, I'm going to read to you a portion of this here, starting there at the beginning of that chapter. So what does all this mean for us? For me, it means that I need to face up to the early Christians. Perhaps that is something we all need to do. For the most part, we Bible-believing Christians simply ignore the early Christians. We rarely talk about them in our churches, and we disregard their writings. Like I said, that's an excellent point. I'm paused from the reading there. Denominations, wholeheartedly, this whole list, they need to face what some of these early Christians wrote. because it comes from the Bible. In regards to modest apparel and group mixed swimming in immodest clothing, maybe some Christians even need to face up to what these Christians wrote as well. He goes on to say, our stance reminds me of the position the Pharisees took towards John the Baptist. When the Pharisees tried to trap Jesus by asking him where his authority came from, he responded by asking them where John had received his authority. The Pharisees huddled together, saying among themselves, if we say from heaven, he'll say to us, why then did you not believe him? But if we say from men, well, we fear the multitude, for all count John as a prophet. So they ended up answering Jesus, we do not know. Matthew 21, 25 through 27. Our approach to the early Christians is very similar. And when I want to make sure I'm saying, it's not our approach here at this congregation, but by and large, Christendom, denominationalism, that is their approach. He says, we can't say their beliefs and lifestyles were correct, because then we would have to acknowledge that our lifestyles and many of our own beliefs are not. On the other hand, we really don't want to accuse them of being heretics, because we cannot deny their unconquerable faith and genuine Christian love. Right? Many of them died for their faith. Furthermore, if we say they were heretics, we would have to admit that our New Testament canon was assembled by heretics. So, like the Pharisees, we refuse to take a position. We simply ignore the early Christians as if we can somehow make them disappear by paying no attention to them. But ignoring them doesn't change the historical truths to which they bear witness. And then he says this next, the very next thing he says. Please understand, I'm not saying we should immediately discard all our beliefs and unquestionably adopt those of the early Christians. I wanted to yell at him through the book. Why? Why not? Right? If you've just acknowledged all this work you've done and you've seen that that's what they did, and why wouldn't you want to do it? And I realize because he sees almost the whole of Christendom as one entire boat. And he says, I can't leap out of the boat, right? I'd be all by myself. He doesn't know that there's other churches out there like ourselves that are doing its best to follow the pattern exactly. He needs to try and do search for that. To find the true church that Jesus built. He goes on to say, but I am saying that we have some skeletons in our theological closets that we need to face up to. For example, many of our evangelical doctrines on salvation are nearly identical to the teachings of the Gnostics. Of course, the Gnostics might have been right while the church was in error. But how likely is that? It is kind of a sad way to end. I think about what Jesus said to a lawyer that came and questioned him. And he said to him, you're not far from the kingdom of heaven. He wasn't in it, but he wasn't far from it. And David Bearcott, by these statements, showing what was taught by early Christians, wasn't far. And I do pray in time that he does find the truth and will stand with those that do teach these truths that are as old as the New Testament itself. I'll read again. The denominational man wrote, we find today's evangelical Christianity far removed from early Christianity. We label as heresy many of the doctrines the early Christians taught. They labeled as heresy many doctrines we teach. Who are the real heretics? Maybe you're here tonight and you've found yourself giving in to heretical beliefs and views. Maybe not by your teaching, but maybe by your practice, maybe by your lifestyle, maybe by the clothes that you wear or the lack of clothing that you wear. God wants you to obey the plan of salvation. And if you do and you repent and are baptized, you can have your sins washed away. You can be newborn, born again. The old man's dead, the new man now lives. And that's what he's wanted to do with all people ever since the gospel was given on the day of Pentecost. If you're God's child and you've forsaken and fallen away, as we've read and studied, one can fall from the faith, fall from the truth, but they can come back to the Lord. Wasn't it so good to see our sister Chelsea do that this morning? We need to pray for her and surround her with love and support and encouragement. She's going to need that more often because Satan's going to want to pull her back away. Has he pulled you away? You can be made right with the Lord once again. That's His wonderful grace that saves. When we've left Him, He doesn't say, "Don't ever come back home." He stands with open arms saying, "Come, whoever so wills may come. Won't you come while we stand and while we sing?" There's a fountain free, 'tis for you and me. Let us haste, oh, haste to its spring. 'Tis a fount of love from the source above, and He bids us all freely drink.
Will you come
to the fountain free?
Will you come?
'Tis for you and me.
Thirsty soul,
hear the well. Come, call, 'tis a fountain open for all.